I want to talk first, before getting into the fine behavior, I want to do the supercritical regime where lambda is, where did it go? There it is. Constant greater than one. And a way to think about it is if you look at the process of what's happening to the queue and just look at the average behavior, at the start, a point is finding lambda neighbors, and then it's getting killed. So if you look at the queue, on average, it's changing by lambda minus 1. So with lambda greater than 1, you have positive drift, and so the queue is increasing. Both of these are scaled by n. Remember, n over 2 rounds is Erdős-Rényi time 1, and I divide the queue size by n as well. So what happens is at the start, the queue as a function of time has positive drift, so it has a positive derivative, but there is an ecological limitation. That is to say, suppose that you've already found a lot of points. Well, you're only looking for new points in BFS. So if there are only alpha n remaining, what I call neutral points, that are remaining to be caught, at that point, on average, you're going to find not lambda, but lambda alpha. And then again, you kill yourself, or you get killed. So now the drift becomes lambda alpha minus 1. So what happens is the more successful you are, the more points you've found, your drift goes down, down, down. Eventually it becomes negative, and the function turns around, and eventually it hits 0. And with fictitious continuation, we can have negative Qs and stuff. And indeed, if you use some of Nick Wormald's ideas, you can show that you're going to fit to this curve pretty well. This is not a parabola, but it's an explicit function. You can get the differential equation, and it's some function. It's some fairly simple function that you can get here. So with that as the idea, let's talk about the giant component. And what I want to say is that your component will, with failure probability little o 1 over n, either be very small or be right around this point where you're hitting 0. It's going to be one or the other. Now, the way we actually argue with it is that the number of neutral points has to be exactly n minus t. That's a necessary condition. It's not sufficient because we may have had an early abort. But it turns out this is what we use. If the component has size t, so we pick a component and look at its. We pick a specific vertex. Well, what's the probability its component has size t? We run the process. It's necessary that with fictitious continuation. When I said fictional, fictitious continuation. At time t, the number of neutral vertices has to be n minus t. But we had said that the number of neutral vertices is given by the binomial distribution. And if you turn, it's better to turn this around and think that binomial n minus 1 comma 1 minus 1 minus p to the t is equal to t minus 1. Now what happens is when t is little o 1, it's this positive drift over here, the 1 minus 1 minus p to the t is like lambda t over n, which is that so that the expected value of this binomial is let me look at 1 minus this, so I want it to be t. So the expected value of the binomial will be the n's cancel out, and it will be lambda t, and lambda is bigger than 1. Okay. So, and that drops exponentially in t. So what happens is if you want the error probability to be little o 1, you go out logarithmically far. So these are the small components. Because indeed, even with lambda equals 5, there's a positive probability that the component will have size 1. That the root has no neighbors, okay? So when you want the failure probability to be n to the minus 1, you go out logarithmically far because the probability is dropping exponentially. So that's how it, so either a component is small, which means it's big O of log n, but even it's even stronger than that. The small ones are usually, I mean, they have a limiting distribution, and it's just quite rare that they're of size logarithmic, but we have n points to start with. That's why we can say they're most log n. But that's a little deceptive when you say that. Most of the small components are size 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. But the biggest small component is k log n. Or, once we pass here, now when we look at 1 minus 1 minus p to the t, yeah, k. Oh, sorry, I didn't make a new line. Case 2 is when t is yn, and now 1 minus 1 minus p to the t is 1 minus e to the minus lambda y, so the binomial would have to be yn. Well, I mean, the chance that binomial n comma 0.3 is 0.4n is exponentially small. You know, I mean, it's like a strong law of large numbers. So. What happens is this is going to be exponentially small. I mean, all we need is little o of n to the minus 1. It's actually exponentially small unless we're right at this value where 1 minus e to the minus lambda y is equal to y, and that's exactly the probability that the Poisson process, the pure Poisson process, is infinite. So what happens is, since the failure probability was little o of 1 over n, with high probability for all vertices, either the component is small, namely big O of log n, or it's giant, namely yn. So this is what I call the no middle ground. We're just not going to have any components of other sizes. They're either going to be small, which is the early abort, or they're going to be giant. Now, the rough feeling is that you start with a point and you start running the process, and at the start it looks just like the Poisson process. And either it aborts, okay, then you get a small component. If it didn't abort, the Poisson process would have gone to infinity. You can't go to infinity because you've only got n vertices. And what happens is that all those points that would have had infinite components, they all join together and form the giant component. That's my gut feeling about it, but that's not really the way the proof goes. So we can actually sandwich the graph process. I mentioned one of these ways before. If you want the probability that a component is greater than or equal to t, we can bound it from above by a Galton-Watson process where we keep replenishing the reservoir. So that's the Galton-Watson process, binomial n minus 1, comma p, which is roughly Poisson. But we can bound it from below by thinking of the reservoir as only having n minus t points all the time. Because once we get t points in our component, we stop with 1. So it's bound. It's sandwiched. It's bounded from below by the Poisson process, where each time you're binomial n minus t comma p from below, and it's bounded from above by the process where where you replenish the reservoir. So in the first case, you deplete the reservoir down to n minus t, and you just keep the reservoir at size n minus t. In the other case, you keep replenishing the reservoir at n minus 1, and so you get the sandwiching. Now, if t is large, that's not particularly good, but if t is relatively small, and certainly if it's logarithmic, this sandwiching gives the asymptotic value. It's just a simple calculation here that changing n minus 1 to n minus t is not going to have much of an effect on the Galton-Watson process. So what happens is the probability that the component is bigger than or equal to k log n is asymptotic to the Galton-Watson process being bigger than or equal to k log n, but there's no n in the Galton-Watson process. What happened? Well, that's the probability that it's infinite. That's the probability that it's infinite. So there's a funny double limit going on. I mean, all these things have these very interesting double limits. The probability, the limit as n approaches infinity, of the probability that the Galton-Watson process has tree size greater than or equal to k log n. Well, that's the probability that the tree is infinite. So it's y. So what happens is the probability that it's large, and we know it's either small or large. So we know that the expected number of small ones is 1 minus y times n, and the expected number of points in a giant component is yn, and furthermore, we know that the giant component has to have size yn. We're almost done. There's a little tricky thing. Maybe we have probability a half of having two giant components. You know, then you'd still... You know, but there are a number of ways around this. One way is by making a variance calculation. You do a variance calculation on the number of points in small components, not on the points in the giant component. But, of course, all points are either in small or giant. So if you look at a point being in a small component, they're basically uncorrelated because the component is only logarithmic size. So from that, what happens is with high probability, S really is 1 minus y times n, and therefore you get that with high probability, the number of points in giant components is yn, but the giant component can only have size yn, and therefore it's unique. It's unique. There's always a little... I always keep thinking there's some book proof lurking here, that because the proofs always have... There's another way of doing this involving sprinkling, which is a wonderful general idea that came from mathematical physics. Imagine... So forget about the variance calculation. So suppose... Could you have, you know, two components of size yn? Well, just sprinkle on a few more edges. That is, just boost your p-value by a tiny little bit. And then, you know, with positive probability, all you need is one edge between them, and that would mean that you'd have a positive probability of having a component of size 2yn. But we haven't really changed asymptotically the value of p. We've just done a little bit of sprinkling, and we know that that can't happen. We know that that won't happen. So you can also use a sprinkling argument. Whoops. Okay. And now let's see if I can... Maybe I have my trusted aide here. There we go. Thank you very much. So now we'll move to the fine behavior. But it's time for an Erdős story. I don't know. How many of you have read Borges? Okay. Everybody that's in mathematics should read Borges. I mean, it's just... Especially this story, The Library of Babel. I mean, you know, it's a story for mathematicians. And this is sort of the central line. The librarian is wandering around the Universal Library looking for the book, you know, that has all of the knowledge. And he says, to me, it does not seem... sounds better in Spanish, but when I was in Mexico, I gave this the original, which was better. To me, it does not seem unlikely that on some shelf of the universe there lies a total book. I pray the unknown gods that some man, even if only one man, and though it have been thousands of years ago, may have examined and read it. If honor and wisdom and happiness are not for me, let them be for others. May heaven exist, though my place be in hell. That's my favorite. Let me be outraged and annihilated, but may thy enormous library be justified for one instant in one being. That's the essence of being a mathematician, right there. That's it. And so now here's the Erdős story that I had the joy of taking Uncle Paul, as we all called him, to a camp for high school, talented high school students. It's still around. It's called Yellow Pig Camp. It's in Northampton, Massachusetts. And it was a beautiful New England summer day. And he spent the whole day, you know, talking with the Epsilons, as he called them. And at the end of the day, it came time for him to give his formal lecture, and so the whole camp gathered around, and I had the honor of doing the introduction. And when I gave the introduction, I spoke about the book, you know, you know what it meant and how it the book had all the theorems in mathematics, and there was just one proof, the book proof. Very fortunately, I made a mistake, and I said, I still don't know why I said it, but I'm so glad I did. I said that the book is held by God. Well, it has a Platonic existence. That's not the same as saying it's held by God. So Erdős never criticized, but when he got up to give his talk, he made a comment that will stay with me forever. He said, well, you don't have to believe in God, but you should believe in the book. So there it is. So that's the Erdős words of wisdom. To me, these are the same. These are isomorphic statements. Okay, enough theology. Let's go back to. Okay, so look, C is less than one. We're subcritical. C is greater than one. We're supercritical. C equals one was looked at in fine detail. That is P equals one over n by Erdős and Rainey in 1960, and it's very subtle. And they got a whole lot of results on it. In particular, that the biggest components were of size n to the 2/3. Not at all obvious why that should be, but it was. And you might say, well, gee, I mean, any real number, it's either less than 1 or bigger than 1 or equal to 1. So that's the end of the story, right? And in fact, we all believed it was the end of the story for 20 years. But it's not the end of the story, because you can put in a lower order term at C equals 1, and you can spread out the C equals 1 case to see things happening. And we now know the way to do it. Here's the way to do it. You set P equal 1 over N plus lambda N to the minus 4/3. Again, why 4/3? Well, I'll give some heuristics why it's the case. And this is the way to scale what's called the critical window. So let me tell you some of the results about what happens. If you're barely supercritical, so by barely, I mean we're still, you know, near 1 over N. Now, so, but technically lambda is going to lambda is going to minus infinity. Sorry, I left out the minus sign. So, but think of it as 1 over n minus 10 n to the minus 4/3. Notice the minus 10 is still well defined. I mean, it's a lower order term. So if P is 1 over n minus 10 lambda to the minus 4 thirds, but more technically lambda is going to infinity, then the maximal component is little o of n to the minus 2 thirds. It's actually n to the 2 thirds times lambda to the minus 2 times the logarithmic term. And what happens is, just like the subcritical, general subcritical case, all the components are still... So the subcritical case goes into the barely subcritical case. It has the same kind of behavior, except that the component sizes are getting bigger. But what's being retained is that all the components are simple. They're either trees or unicyclic. And what's also... being preserved is a kind of locality that the second largest component and the largest component are around the same size. In fact, the 10th largest component and the largest component are around the same size. Okay, not the second order terms, but asymptotically. So the barely subcritical behaves in many ways like the subcritical. You're moving up, 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 up. And then when you get to barely supercritical, that is 1 over n plus 10, n to the minus 4 thirds, you don't yet have a giant component, but you have the dominant component. A Jupiter has arisen that dominates all of our components. There's the giant component has size around 2 lambda n to the 2 thirds, and lambda is going to plus infinity. It is not a tree nor unicyclic. In fact, if you define the complexity as edges minus vertices plus 1, so the number of edges beyond a tree that you have in the graph, remember these are connected, these are components we're talking about. So its complexity is actually high. And we have a duality that if you remove the maximal component, it's as if you're in the barely subcritical phase where lambda is replaced by lambda to the minus, but lambda is replaced by minus lambda. So all of the other components, the second biggest component, is going to be little o of n to the minus 2 thirds, and it and all the others are going to be simple. So I think I got this. So there's a lambda is going to infinity. So this is bigger than n to the 2 thirds, and this is little o of n to the... Oh, I'm sorry, that's not minus. That's lambda to the plus 2 thirds. Sorry about that. The component sizes are lambda to the 2 thirds. Okay. So what's happened is the giant has emerged. It's not yet giant, but it's dominant. And in fact, there's a lot of results that... the giant component just stays a giant. It's not that it's overtaken by somebody else. And there are a lot of results in this. So it just keeps on pulling in. You know, this Jupiter, it has a big gravitational force, and it keeps pulling other components into it, and it gets bigger and bigger. And so it's a very nice picture. And the critical window is for lambda fixed. And lambda can be... zero or positive or negative. There's no problem with looking at 1 over n minus 4 over n to the 4 thirds. It turns out zero is not special. There's no critical window inside the critical window. This is it. This is the whole story. Lambda equals 0 and lambda equals 1. There's no macroscopic difference between the two of them. And what happens is that for any fixed lambda, things have a complicated distribution. If you're subcritical or supercritical, when you look at things, they have concentration. Whatever they are, that's what they are. I mean, they're that with high probability. They're concentrated, like the largest component, the size is concentrated. But in the critical window, you have chaotic behavior. The size of the largest component will be on the order of n to the 2 thirds. But if you scale it by n to the 2 thirds, if you call the largest component, say, x1 n to the 2 thirds, x1 has a complicated distribution. Furthermore, the complexity, it might be a tree, It might be unicyclic, it might be bicyclic. There's sort of there's a limiting distribution there as well, which again is quite complicated. It's quite complicated. And all these things are in distribution. And there's a complicated point process. Indeed, let me mention about the point process. So this is some stuff that was done formally. Svante Janssen and I did it. So if you take a fixed lambda and you look at the components and you look at the big components and you divide them, you scale them by n to the 2/3, so so you'll have some component of size C1 n to the 2/3, and then maybe you'll have one of size C2 n to the 2/3, and the third largest will be C3 n to the 2/3. And as you get closer and closer to zero here, you'll get more and more points. But what happens is you have a very interesting point process on the positive real. In the limit, you have a point process on the positive reals. So this holds for every lambda, but there's a very interesting thing that happens. The POM process, which some of your students are working on, let's suppose that you have the POM process, the general notion of what's called POM process. There was some guy named POM. It's not POM, I was told that. I don't know who he was. But the general notion is you have a point process, and then if you condition on a particular point being there, what's the conditional distribution? Okay, and what happens here is very nice, that if you condition on a point being at C, it doesn't have to be the biggest one, and any value of C, what happens is you get the unconditioned process with lambda replaced by lambda minus C. So it's really it's an interesting picture. For every lambda, you've got this point process, and then the POM process is, so this is not Poisson. I mean, they're not independent. I mean, if you have a component of size 30 n to the 2/3, it sucked up the oxygen out of the room, and the other components are going to be much smaller. But what happens is the exact, and this is exact, you know, in the limiting behavior, that when you, in the POM process, it's you just replace lambda by lambda minus C. So it's quite nice that way. Okay. Yeah. Yes, sir.
Distributions related to excursion, Brownian excursion.
Sorry?
Are those those complicated distributions related to...
Oh, absolutely. And I don't know where David is, but there he is. Yeah, so definitely. I mean, there are a lot of different approaches to this, and that's a very good one. Yes. Yeah. Okay. So why is the... I mentioned last time, the explanation for y n to the minus 4/3 is that the small components are like go up to epsilon to the minus 2, and the giant component's supposed to be 2 epsilon n. And so if you look at the argument for if you look at the argument for supercriticality for the dominant component, you need that those small components are smaller than the giant component. So if you look at this argument that you have here and the dichotomy between small and large, and then you let lambda equal 1 plus epsilon, and now you let epsilon go to 0 as a function of n. For any fixed epsilon, you have the dichotomy. But now you let epsilon go to 0 as a function of n, then the place where the small and large meet, so the small is basically epsilon to the minus 2, and the large is basically 2 epsilon n, and they meet at n to the minus 4/3, or epsilon is n to the minus 1/3, So P is 1 over N plus lambda over N to the 4/3 when you recalibrate. Okay. And I just gave this to my students, and they had a lot of fun, and you'll have a lot of fun too if you enjoy some programming. So give it a try. Put on your CS hat or find a friend that's good at programming. Have that person do it, whatever. Start with a million vertices. Where did it go? Yeah, start with your million vertices. Let's say, I keep raising the number every year because the computers get faster. And you start with no edges, and you put in random edges one at a time, and you keep track of the component sizes. And if you check with your CS friends, there's an algorithm called Union Find that does this basically in linear time. There's a constant time per edge that you add. So that's the algorithm to use. And now you parameterize round E. You're really interested right near N over 2. So you look where the number of rounds is, multiplying by N squared over 2, is N over 2 plus lambda N to the to the 2/3 over 2. Okay, so you and now just look at it from, say, minus 4 to plus 4. Because actually, I mean, technically lambda is going to minus infinity and plus infinity. Really, you see it very well between, if you let minus infinity be minus 4 and plus infinity be plus 4, you know, you'll see it quite well. And you can just actually see, I always wanted somebody that's good in graphics to come up with a nice movie for this. Hasn't happened yet. You can really see the dominant component emerging. What happens is at lambda equals minus 4, you have this asteroid belt, but without a Ceres. I mean, all the asteroids are kind of tiny, you know. But then they're merging, and there's this whole merge dynamic. They have this gravitational force, which is proportional to, like gravity, proportional to the product of their masses, and there's no distance here. These are abstract graphs, so you have a merge dynamic, and what happens is a lot of these asteroids merge, and they form the dominant component. What I always find particularly interesting is the second largest component. The second largest component gets bigger, and then it gets smaller. How can the second largest component get smaller? Well, when the second largest component merges with the first largest component, the second largest component is the old third largest component, so the size of the second largest component has dropped. Notice that that's a discontinuous kind of thing. It'll just drop. What happens is you have two countervailing forces. The second largest is just picking, has its own gravitation, and it, you know, so it, the Saturn is picking up stuff, so it's getting bigger. But then at a certain point, Jupiter and Saturn merge, and who knows the third largest planet?
Uranus.
Is that right? I thought that was. I didn't say, okay. And then Uranus, which is a lot smaller than Saturn, becomes the new second largest. And so it's very interesting to see the rise and fall. Another thing that's interesting is the susceptibility. So remember, the susceptibility has a normalization, was the sum of the squares of the component sizes. And what happens is this gets more and more dominated by the largest component. Because the largest component is still still only a dominant, it's not a giant component. So it doesn't dominate in terms of the number of vertices. But when you look at the square, it starts to dominate. And if you look at it, lambda equals minus 4, its contribution is only a small proportion of the sum of the squares of the component sizes. But by the time you get to lambda equals plus 4, it's like 99% or so. So again, a lot of wonderful things, and I certainly encourage you to get on your computer. And then these things run very, very quickly, you know. And lots more, yeah. So do it. Try it. Yeah. The actual calculations in the critical window are scary. I mean, you really have to be careful. It's so easy to make mistakes, and I'll just give you one example. Suppose that P is in the critical window, and let's let K be constant C times n to the 2/3, and we want to know the number of tree components of size K. Well, we have an exact formula. There are n choose k choices for the k points, then k to the k minus 1 choices for the tree by Cayley's formula. Shouldn't that be k minus 2? Yeah, sorry, the number of errors here. This is k to the k minus 2, but the theory's right. And then you have p to the k minus 1. You have to have those edges in. And then you've got a whole bunch of pairs that are not edges. So it's 1 minus p to this power. Well, so what are the asymptotics? How hard can it be? Well, really, really hard. I mean, it's an asymptotic problem. But it turns out that the approximation of n choose k, when k is on the order of n to the 2/3, there's a secondary term, and then at n to the 2/3, a tertiary term comes in, and that turns out to be critical. That turns out to be critical. So, I mean, these things are just extraordinarily delicate. And when you do it correctly, as I have not up here, but when you do it correctly, you get this result that the expected number of tree components is given by this function of C, a mysterious function of C, times n to the minus 2/3. Well, that doesn't sound too good, except that that's having a tree component of size exactly k. And we're not interested in having it exactly k. I mean, we're saying that the giant components are on the order of n to the 2/3. So if we turn this into a distribution function, the density, the n to the 2/3, disappears. And so we get this interesting density function. So we actually know in this process, if you look at any particular point, we know the density of that point. But, as I said before, they're not independent. They have a very interesting correlation, in particular this result that I mentioned before about the POM process. So very intriguing. I mean, if you like point processes, This one is a good one. This one is a good one. Let me turn to a method for asymptotic counting. Suppose I want to count the number of unicyclic graphs, which is a problem that a number of people, it's a long history, including Alfred Rainey, but many others, too, were able to find it. Here's one way to do it that I particularly like because it involves Brownian motion. So I'm going to think of K fixed and N going to infinity, but in work with, where did Remco go? Anyway, in work, there he is. Okay, in work with Remco, we can look at these things when k is going to infinity as well. But let's just stick to k fixed. So, in particular, k equals 1, unicyclic graphs. So, let's label the graphs 0 through n minus 1, and let's run a breadth first search on a unicyclic graph. So we can do it in any way, but let's certainly specify the way. That is, you know, which ones so we'll put things into the queue in numerical order. As long as it's a specific way, that's okay. So given any let me just do k equals 1. Given any unicyclic graph, it maps into what's called its breadth first search tree, which will be a tree on the same vertices, and therefore the total number of unicyclic graphs, well, the thing is, this is many to one. And the problem is, it's not the same number to one all the time. So to count the unicyclic ones, for each tree, we count the number of unicyclic ones that had that tree as its breadth-first search. Now let's just express that in probabilistic terms. It's n to the n minus 2, so this time I got Cayley's formula right, times the expected number of unicyclic that give a random tree, where t is chosen uniformly from among the n to the n minus 2. Now, what is BFS inverse of t? I suppose that I tell you that this was the breadth first search tree. Well, how many unicyclic trees, how many unicyclic graphs could this have come from? Well, you have to add an edge, but you can't just add any edge. You see, you can't add the edge 0, 4, because then when we did breadth first search, we would have gotten the edge 0, 4. So the only edges, if we look at the queue starts at 0, and then it's 3, 5, and then 3 is replaced by 1 and 2, 5 disappears, 1 disappears, 2 is replaced by 4, and I think I got it right, 1 and 2, yeah. Right, okay. So I'll make a combinatorial statement that the only edges you can add are edges XY when Y was in the queue when X was popped. Let's say X is the first one to be popped in the thing. So that is to say, if you look at 1, 4, that never appears. You can't have the edge 1, 4 as your extra edge, because when you were doing breadth first search, when you got to 1, you would have taken the edge 1, 4. I'm assuming we're doing it in this order. But on the other hand, an edge like 5, 1, I was told not to use the colored chalk, but I'll make an exception in this case. See, if you look at 5, 1, this is going to give the same breadth-first search tree, because first 0 found 3 and 5, then 3 found 1 and 2, and 5 didn't find 1 because 1 had already been found, so it's not looking for it. So the edges that you can add on are the pairs where if you let X be the first point that's popped, Y was in the queue at that time. So how many of those points are there? I don't know what happened here. Okay. So what happens is the number of edges that we can, the number of choices of edges that we can add is M. We just sum over the Q curve the size of the queue minus 1. So in this case, there are exactly 4 edges we could add. We could add the edge 3, 5. We could add the edge 5, 1. We could add the edge 5, 2. We could add the edge 1, 2. So the number of edges that we can add is really, it's like an integral. I mean, it's discrete, but it's the sum of the queue sizes minus 1. So now what happens is Now we want to look at a random tree and that is uniform among the n to the n minus 2 trees. There are a lot of ways to do that, but here's the way I want to do it. I want to say that you have vertices. You start with vertex 0. Vertex j joins the tree at time w sub j, which is uniform from which is uniform from 1 to n. Maybe it's n minus 1. And so you let x sub t be the number of points joining at time t. So that's roughly a Poisson with mean 1. And then you look at the Q curve. But in order for it to be a tree, it has to go to 0 for the first time. The first time the Q is 0 has to be at n. Yeah, at 0 you're at 1, or at, yeah, at n, okay. So the Q starts at 1, and then you go, but now in order for it to be a tree, so you think of this as you're putting balls into bins, okay. Each vertex, except for the root, decides when it's going to join the tree by making it uniform, a uniform choice. But then, in order for this to work, the Q curve has to hit 0 for the first time. Now, it's going to hit 0 because you only have n balls and n minus 1 bins, so it will hit 0 at time n, but you want that to be, you don't want early abort. So we get this excursion, and M is the area, the discrete area under the Q curve. But in the limit, so here you need a real probabilist, not me, but in the limit, you can say that this is Brownian excursion. That is to say, each step, the step sizes are Poisson 1 minus 1. But that means they're mean 0 and variance 1. So in the limit, it's looking like a Brownian excursion. And M is the area under the curve in the Brownian excursion. So Brownian excursion means when you scale things, when you do the right scaling, so here's the actual Q curve, and then and this is n, and now you scale this by square root of n, and you scale this by n, and then you get some kind of Brownian excursion. So now it's 0, 1. That's the right scaling. Fairly standard scaling for discrete processes by Brownian excursion. When you scale it, M is the area under the curve. The scaling introduced a factor of N to the 3 halves. So now, if you want to know, let's just do it for general fixed K, that when you want complexity K, you want to add K edges. You have capital M edges that you can add. So you're looking at the expected value of m to the k, but the scaling gives you an n to the 3 halves to the k. And then the other term is something that's been well studied, which is you take the standard Brownian excursion and what is its kth moment for k fixed? And there are results on that. And so you get this asymptotic formula. You get this asymptotic formula. Now, this has been done in many other ways. In particular, E.M. Wright has a series of very important papers where he gets this, not using this at all, and very combinatorial, not talking about Brownian excursion. But I think the connection to Brownian excursion is a nice one. So what happens, one thing that's not really obvious is where did the n to the 3 halves come from? And I still don't have a really nice picture of it, but why is that? Why should unicyclic be n to the 3 halves times the number of trees. Well, I mean, after all, you could take a tree and you could add n square other edges. But then you'd be multiply counting, because then you'd get a cycle, but then you could delete any one of those edges in the cycle and go back to the tree. But this is the way it is. The scaling is every time you want to add an extra edge, every time you want to increase k, you go up by a power of n to the 3/2, and then you have these constants, which are given in terms of the Brownian excursion, but were originally found by E.M. Wright. And the first one, which was done by many people, as I mentioned, and there are many arguments for it, but in particular I like to mention Alfred Rainey, the eponymous Rainey Institute. And the first one is root pi over 8, yeah. Yeah.
Is it because the cycle length is order root n?
Yes, yeah. That's basically what's happening. The cycles are of order root n, and that's what's happening. Yeah?
Just a clarification. This holds in the scaling window, this result?
No, there's no probability here. There's no probability here. Think of it that I move to another thing. I'm just doing a count. There's no probability. I just want to count the number of unicyclic.
The expression you have, does it fall in the scaling window?
No, that's not the question. Oh. Because the result has nothing to do with, I mean, it uses probability, but it has nothing to do with GNP. I'm counting the number of unicyclic graphs, and the way I'm doing it is to look at random trees. But now I'm going to apply it to the scaling window. But yeah, sorry, I switched gears in the middle, and my apologies for that. I should have mentioned that we're switching gears, and now I want to go back. Now let me go back to the scaling window. What happens is the trees, the unicyclic ones, give a comparable factor to the trees, because with the unicyclic ones, you get an extra factor of n to the 3/2, but that is scaled out because you have an extra factor of p. So, the n scales out. I'm losing the factors. But what happens is when you plug in here to the unicyclic ones, you get the same formula as for the trees, the n, the additional n to the 3/2 for the unicyclic, but then there's an extra factor of p. Anyway, they all the n factors cancel out. You get the same thing, except you get an extra factor of c sub k, and you get an extra factor of c to the 3/2, where the component size is of size c. So you get a complicated density function, and this involves the fact that in the critical window, if you have something of size c n to the 2/3, it could be a tree or unicyclic or bicyclic or tricyclic, and it has a complex distribution.
Hmm? 2 minutes left.
2 minutes left. Okay. So let me then end with since Lutz said I had 2 minutes left, let me mention Lutz's work. So let's talk about the product rule. So here's a process where we really don't understand. So let me end with this. So this is similar to Bowman-Fries. Each round, I pick 4 vertices, x1, x2, y1, y2. I'll either join x1 and x2, or I'll join y1 and y2. I look at the products of the sizes of the components, of x1 and x2, and of y1 and y2. And I pick the one that has the smaller product, and I add that edge. So, okay, there are 1,000 different rules you could make. This one turns out to be really an interesting one, and it has a strong repulsion, because if you've got 2 fairly good-sized components, the product of their sizes is really big. So even if you happen to pick X1 and X2, one from the two, you know, that product is almost certainly going to be bigger than the other product, and so you're not going to pick it. I mean, that's the idea. So there's a strong anti-gravity going on. So again, you can look at the component size. We use Erdős-Rényi time, and we see, so this is time, and this is the maximal component, and what we do, we work it out for 10 to the 7th, or 10 to the 8th, or 10 to the 9th, and what we see very, very clearly from our data is that it's zero up to around 1.78, and then it jumps discontinuously to around 0.6. Dimitri Akleoptis and Risa D'Souza and I conjectured that that was exactly the case, that we had a first-order phase transition, and, something wonderful happened. Our conjecture was false. And Lutz and Oliver, he was your advisor at the time, or were you already postdoc? So, yeah, okay. And they actually, not only did we not have a proof of the conjecture, but they gave a proof that our conjecture was wrong. So they actually proved that there really is a continuous curve here. But at 10 to the 6th, we didn't see it. Somehow we think at around 10 to the 23rd, we might start to see. And so here are some open questions. I'll just finish with some open questions. What does it look like? What's the scaling for the critical window? My favorite question, what's the biggest, the second largest component? It's certainly not n to the 2/3, but we don't know what it is. It's very big. And what on earth is going on? So thank you very much for your attention.
Reinterpret in a roundabout way the size of the maximum component in Erdős-Rényi in the following way. So the edges are appearing at some time t. So you look at a maximum size connected cluster of edges such that the maximum arrival time is less than t. That's just a roundabout way of saying the first relation cluster. However, I change the second maximum to average. I say I want to look at the maximum size of a connected set of edges such that the average of their birth times is less than t. So it's now easy to do Erdős-Rényi. There's a sort of critical, explicit critical value of t such that sort of smaller than the critical value, you just have these sort of small tree-shaped components, and sort of larger than the critical value, you have a giant component. That's sort of 5 pages to prove doing the obvious thing. After that, nothing. So all these questions about the second order behavior and scaling windows are open. Why do I care? It's sort of maximum of averages. And in my vague, fuzzy way of thinking, that's what the Tracy Witham universality class is about, maximum of averages. So this is either Tracy Witham or some new universality class which you can name after yourself. So, a good project for ambitious young people.
Okay, good. Thank you.
No further questions, and let's thank Joe again.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.